And now back to Napoleon Hill's original text. Blessings in disguise. I used to hate my enemies, but that was before I learned how well they were serving me by keeping me everlastingly on the alert lest some weak spot in my character provide an opening through which they might damage me. In view of what I have learned of the value of enemies, if I had none, I would feel it my duty to create a few. They would discover my defects and point them out to me, whereas my friends, if they saw my weaknesses at all, would say nothing about them. Of all Joaquin Miller's poems, none expressed a nobler thought than did this one. All honor to him who shall win a prize. The world has cried for 1,000 years, but to him who tries and who fails and dies, I give great honor and glory and tears. Give glory and honor and pitiful tears to all who fail in their deeds sublime. Their ghosts are many in the van of years. They were born with time, in advance of time. Oh, great is the hero who wins a name, but greater many and many a time some pale-faced fellow who dies in shame and lets God finish the thought sublime. And great is the man with a sword undrawn, and good is the man who refrains from wine, but the man who fails and yet still fights on, lo, he's the twin brother of mine. There can be no failure for the person who still fights on. No one has ever failed until they accept temporary defeat as failure. And there is a wide difference between the two, a difference I have tried to emphasize throughout this lesson. I am convinced that failure is nature's plan through which she hurdle-jumps those of destiny and prepares them to do their work. Failure is nature's great crucible in which she burns the dross from the human heart and so purifies the metal of the person that it can stand the test of hard usage. I have found evidence to support this theory in the study of the records of scores of great men, from Socrates and Christ on down the centuries to the well-known men of achievement of our times. The success of each seemed to be an almost exact ratio to the extent of the obstacles and difficulties he had to surmount. No one ever arose from the knockout blow of defeat without being stronger and wiser for the experience. Of course, one must have considerable courage to look upon defeat as a blessing in disguise, but the attainment of any position in life that is worth having requires a lot of sand. This brings to mind a poem that harmonizes with the philosophy of this lesson. I observed a locomotive in the railroad yards one day. It was waiting in the roundhouse where the locomotives stay. It was panting for the journey, it was cold and fully manned, and it had a box the fireman was filling full of sand. It appears that locomotives cannot always get a grip on their slender iron pavement, 'cause the wheels are apt to slip, and when they reach a slippery spot, their tactics they command, and to get a grip upon the rail, they sprinkle it with sand. It's about the way with travel along life's slippery track. If your load is rather heavy, you're always slipping back. So, if a common locomotive you completely understand, you'll provide yourself in starting with a good supply of sand. If your track is steep and hilly, and you have a heavy grade, if those who've gone before you have the rails quite slippery made, if you ever reach the summit of the upper tableland, you'll find you'll have to do it with a liberal use of sand. If you strike some frigid weather, and discover to your cost that you're liable to slip upon a heavy coat of frost, then some prompt decided action will be called into demand, and you'll slip way to the bottom if you haven't any sand. You can get to any station that is on life's schedule scene if there's fire beneath the boiler of ambition's strong machine, and you'll reach a place called Flushtown at a rate of speed that's grand if for all the slippery places you've a good supply of sand. It can do you no harm to memorize the poems quoted in this lesson and make the philosophy upon which they are based a part of your own. There's a bit of philosophy taken from the works of the great Shakespeare that I wish to challenge because I believe it to be unsound. It is stated in the following quotation. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a full sea are we now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures. Fear and admission of failure are the ties that cause us to be bound in shallows and in miseries. We can break these ties, turn them to advantage, and make them serve as a tow line with which to pull ourselves ashore if we observe and profit by the lessons they teach. Who ne'er has suffered, he has lived but half. Who never failed, he never strove or sought. Who never wept is stranger to a laugh. And he who never doubted, never thought. Great Failures. As I near the end of this, my favorite lesson of this course, I close my eyes for a moment and see before me a great army of men and women whose faces show the lines of care and despair. Some are in rags, having reached the last stage of that long, long trail which some call failure. Others are in better circumstances, but the fear of starvation shows plainly on their faces. The smile of courage has left their lips, and they, too, seem to have given up the battle. The scene shifts. I look again, and I am carried backward into the history of man's struggle for a place in the sun. And there I also see the failures of the past, failures that have meant more to the human race than all the so-called successes recorded in the history of the world. I see the homely face of Socrates as he stood at the very end of that trail called failure, waiting with upturned eyes through those moments that must have seemed like an eternity, just before he drank the cup of hemlock that was forced upon him by his tormentors. I see Christopher Columbus, a prisoner in chains, which was the tribute paid him for his sacrifice in having set sail on an unknown and uncharted sea to discover an unknown continent. I see the face of Thomas Paine, the man whom the English sought to capture and put to death as the real instigator of the American Revolution. I see him lying in a filthy prison in France as he waited calmly, under the shadow of the guillotine, for the death that he expected would be meted out to him for his part in behalf of humanity. And I see the face of the man of Galilee, as he suffered on the cross of Calvary, the reward he received for his efforts in behalf of suffering humanity. Failures, all. Oh, to be such a failure! Oh, to go down in history, as these men did, as one who was brave enough to place humanity above the individual, and principle above pecuniary gain. On such failures rest the hopes of the world. O men who are labeled failures, up, rise up, again, and do. Somewhere in the world of action is room, there is room for you. No failure was e'er recorded in the annals of truthful men, except of the craven-hearted who fails, nor attempts again. The glory is in the doing, and not in the trophy won. The walls that are laid in darkness may laugh to the kiss of the sun. O weary and worn and stricken, O child of fate's cruel gales, I sing that it haply may cheer him. I sing to the man who fails. Be thankful for the defeat that many call failure, because if you can survive it and keep on trying, it gives you a chance to prove your ability to rise to the heights of achievement in your chosen field of endeavor. No one has the right to brand you as a failure except yourself. If, in a moment of despair, you should feel inclined to brand yourself as a failure, just remember those words of the wealthy philosopher Croesus, advisor to Cyrus, king of the Persians. I am reminded, O king, and take this lesson to heart, that there is a wheel on which the affairs of men revolve, and its mechanism is such that it prevents any man from being always fortunate. What a wonderful lesson is wrapped up in those words, a lesson of hope and courage and promise. Who of us has not seen off days when everything seemed to go wrong? These are the days when we only see the flat side of the great wheel of life. Let us remember that the wheel is always turning. If it brings us sorrow today, it will bring us joy tomorrow. Life is a cycle of varying events, fortunes and misfortunes. We cannot stop this wheel of fate from turning, but we can modify the misfortune it brings us by remembering that good fortune will follow, just as surely as night follows day, if we maintain faith in ourselves and earnestly and honestly do our best. In his greatest hours of trial, the immortal Lincoln was often heard to say, "And this too will soon pass." If you are hurting from the effects of some temporary defeat that you find hard to forget, let me recommend the poem Opportunity by Walter Malone. They do me wrong who say I come no more. When once I knock and fail to find you in, for every day I stand outside your door. and bid you wake, and rise to fight and win. Wail not for precious chances passed away. Weep not for golden ages on the wane. Each night I burn the records of the day. At sunrise, every soul is born again. Laugh like a boy at splendors that have sped. To vanished joys be blind and deaf and dumb. My judgment seal the dead past with its dead, but never bind a moment yet to come. Though deep in mire, wring not your hands and weep. I lend my arm to all who say, I can. No shame-faced outcast ever sank so deep, but yet might rise and be again a man. Dost thou behold thy lost youth all aghast? Dost reel from righteous retribution's blow? Then turn from blotted archives of the past and find the future's pages white as snow. Art thou a mourner? Rouse thee from thy spell. Art thou a sinner? Sin may be forgiven. Each morning gives thee wings to flee from hell. Each night, a star to guide thy feet to heaven. Failure, an after-the-lesson visit with the author. An all-wise providence has arranged the affairs of mankind so that every person who comes into the age of reason must bear the cross of failure in one form or another. The heaviest and most cruel of all the crosses is poverty. Hundreds of millions of people living on this earth today find it necessary to struggle under the burden of this cross in order to enjoy the three bare necessities of life: a place to sleep, something to eat, and clothes to wear. Carrying the cross of poverty is no joke, but it seems significant that some of the greatest and most successful men and women who ever lived found it necessary to carry this cross before they arrived. Failure is generally accepted as a curse. But few people ever understand that failure is a curse only when it is accepted as such, and few ever learn the truth that failure is seldom permanent. Go back over your own experiences for a few years, and you will see that your failures generally turned out to be blessings in disguise. Failure teaches people lessons that they would never learn without it. Among the great lessons taught by failure is that of humility. No one may become great without feeling themselves humble and insignificant when compared with the world around them, the stars above them, and the harmony with which nature does her work. For every rich man's son who becomes a useful, constructive worker in behalf of humanity, there are 99 others rendering useful service who come up through poverty and misery. This seems more than a coincidence. Most people who believe themselves to be failures are not failures at all. Most conditions that people look upon as failure are nothing more than temporary defeat. Careful analysis of 100 men and women whom the world has accepted as being great shows that they were compelled to undergo hardship and temporary defeat and failure, such as you probably have never known and never will know. Lincoln died without knowing that his failure gave sound foundation to the greatest nation on this earth. Columbus died without ever knowing that his failure meant the discovery of the great nation that Lincoln helped to preserve with his failure. Do not use the word failure carelessly. Remember, carrying a burdensome cross temporarily is not failure. If you have the real seed of success within you, a little adversity and temporary defeat will only serve to nurture that seed and cause it to burst forth into maturity. When divine intelligence wants a great man or woman to render some needed service in the world, the fortunate one is tested through some form of failure. If you are undergoing what you believe to be failure, have patience. You may be passing through your testing time. No capable executive would select as his lieutenants those whom he had not tested for reliability, loyalty, perseverance, and other essential qualities. Responsibility, and all that goes with it in the way of remuneration, always gravitates to the person who will not accept temporary defeat as permanent failure. The test of a man is the fight he makes, the grit that he daily shows, the way he stands on his feet and takes fate's numerous bumps and blows. A coward can smile when there's naught to fear, when nothing his progress bars, but it takes a man to stand up and cheer while some other fellow stars. It isn't the victory, after all, but the fight that a brother makes. The man who, driven against the wall, still stands up erect and takes the blows of fate with his head held high, bleeding and bruised and pale, is the man who'll win in the by and by, for he isn't afraid to fail. It's the bumps you get and the jolts you get, and the shocks that your courage stands, the hours of sorrow and vain regret, the prize that escapes your hands, that test your mettle and prove your worth. It isn't the blows you deal, but the blows you take on the good old earth that show if your stuff is real. Failure often places one in a position where unusual effort must be forthcoming. Many have wrung victory from defeat, fighting with their back to the wall where they could not retreat. Caesar had long wished to conquer the British. He quietly sailed his soldier-laden ships to the British island, unloaded his troops and supplies, then gave the order to burn all the ships. Calling his soldiers about him, he said, "Now it is win or perish. We have no choice." And they won. Men usually win when they make up their minds to do so. Burn your bridges behind you and observe how well you work when you know that you have no retreat. A streetcar conductor got a leave of absence while he tried out a position in a great commercial business. "If I do not succeed in holding my new position," he remarked to a friend, "I can always come back to the old job." At the end of the month, he was back, completely cured of all ambition to do anything except work on a streetcar. Had he resigned, instead of asking for a leave of absence, he might have made good in the new job. Observe that everyone who travels the road of life carries a cross. Remember, as you take inventory of your own burdens, that nature's richest gifts go to those who meet failure without flinching or whining. Nature's ways are not easily understood. If they were, no one could be tested for great responsibility through failure. In her poem entitled "When Nature Wants a Man," Angela Morgan expressed a great truth in support of the theory set out in this lesson on profiting by failure, that adversity and defeat are generally blessings in disguise. Editor's Commentary. American journalist, author, poet, and lecturer Angela Morgan was born in Yazoo County, Mississippi, in what she claimed was 1883, but biographers think was likely closer to 1875. Prior to the First World War, Morgan worked as a reporter and feature writer for the Chicago Daily American, the New York American, and the Boston American. In 1915, she was assigned to interview a prominent New York preacher. After he read her poem, "God's Man," to his congregation, it was published in Collier's Weekly. Mrs. John Henry Hammond soon became aware of her work, and Morgan became a full-time poet under the patronage of Mrs. Hammond and later Mrs. Andrew Carnegie, which may explain why Napoleon Hill has given her so much space in this book. It was Mrs. Carnegie who had Morgan's poem, "Battle Cry of the Mothers," printed in booklet form. In April of 1915, as a delegate to the International Congress of Women at The Hague, Holland, Morgan recited the poem and it became a feminist anthem for pacifism. She later wrote under contract with the International Feature Syndicate, as well as for most major magazines of the time, and in 1936 was named Poet Laureate of the National Federation of Women's Clubs. Morgan wrote more than 14 books of poems, one novel, and a book of short stories. Angela Morgan died in 1957. The following poem was published in 1918 in her book, Forward March. When nature wants to drill a man, and thrill a man, and skill a man, when nature wants to mold a man, to play the noblest part, when she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise, watch her method, watch her ways, how she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects, how she hammers him and hurts him, and with mighty blows converts him into trial shapes of clay which only nature understands, while his tortured heart is crying and he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks when his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, and with every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man, and shake a man, and wake a man, when nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill, and she yearns with all her soul, to create him large and whole, what cunning she prepares him, how she goads and never spares him, how she wets him and she frets him, and in poverty begets him, how often she disappoints, whom she secretly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting and his pride may not forget. Bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned, though he may not understand, gives him passions to command. How remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. When nature wants to name a man, and fame a man, and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man, to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that she reckoning may bring, when she wants a god or king, how she reins him and restrains him, so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning, for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets a challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can, so doth nature make a man. Then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls a mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, and relentlessly stands o'er him. Climb or perish, so she says. Watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind, could we understand her mind? Fools are they who call her blind. When his feet are torn and bleeding, yet his spirit mounts unheeding, all his higher powers speeding, blazing newer paths and fine, when the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat. Lo, the crisis, lo, the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation? Then doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. There is no failure. That which looks to be failure is usually nothing but temporary defeat. Make sure that you do not accept it as permanent. Lesson 15. Tolerance. You can do it if you believe you can. I will begin this lesson about tolerance by pointing out the two significant features of intolerance. The first is that intolerance is a form of ignorance which must be mastered before any form of enduring success can be attained. It makes enemies in business and in the professions. It disintegrates the organized forces of society in 1,000 forms. It is the chief cause of all wars and a barrier to the abolition of war. It dethrones reason and substitutes mob psychology in its place. The second is that intolerance is the chief disintegrating force in the organized religions of the world, where it plays havoc with the greatest power for good by breaking up that power into small sects and denominations that spend as much effort opposing each other as they do in destroying the evils of the world. But this indictment against intolerance is general. Let's look at how it affects you, the individual. It is, of course, obvious that anything which impedes the progress of civilization also stands as a barrier to each individual. Stating it conversely, anything that clouds the mind of the individual and retards mental, moral, and spiritual development also retards the progress of civilization. All of this is an abstract statement of a great truth, and inasmuch as abstract statements are neither interesting nor informative, let us proceed to more concretely illustrate the damaging effects of intolerance. Intolerance. I will start by describing an incident that I have mentioned quite freely in practically every public address I have delivered within the past 5 years. I caution you not to read into it a meaning that I had not intended. You will do yourself an injustice if you neglect to study this illustration in the exact words with the exact meaning that I have intended those words to convey. As you hear it, place yourself in my position and see if you have not had a parallel experience. And if so, what lesson did it teach you? One day I was introduced to a young man of unusually fine appearance. His clear eyes, his warm hand clasp, the tone of his voice, and the splendid taste with which he was groomed marked him as a young man of high intellect, the typical young American college student type. As I looked him over, hurriedly studying his personality, as one will naturally do under such circumstances, I observed a Knights of Columbus pin on his vest. Instantly, I released his hand as if it were a piece of ice. This was done so quickly that it surprised both him and me. As I excused myself and started to walk away, I glanced down at the Masonic pin that I wore on my own vest, then took another look at his Knights of Columbus pin and wondered why a couple of trinkets such as these could dig such a deep chasm between men who knew nothing of each other. Editor's Commentary. Although most listeners today will have some familiarity with Masonic lodges and the Knights of Columbus, their role in American society has changed considerably in the time since Napoleon Hill wrote this anecdote. A brief overview of the two organizations will help to put this story into perspective. The Masons are a fraternal organization, some say a secret society, that began in Europe and adopted the name and tools of ancient architects and builders as symbolic of their beliefs. Although the exact date of origin of Freemasonry is unknown, the significant time as it pertains to Hill's story dates to the 18th century Age of Enlightenment. While its membership was Catholic in the beginning, by the late 1600s, Masonry required of its members only that they believe in a supreme being to be worshipped as the individual saw fit. They also embraced public education, the separation of church and state, equality of all men under the law, including the clergy, and other goals of the Enlightenment. These ideas were in direct opposition to the beliefs of the Roman Catholic Church of the day. Further, the craft, as Freemasonry is also called, had secret vows and rituals, a practice that was forbidden by the Church because of the belief that nothing could be held secret from the confessional. Between 1738 and 1902, there were 21 papal bulls condemning Freemasonry. By the time Hill was writing his story, Masonic lodges in America were largely perceived as strongholds of pro-American Protestantism. In many cases, this equated with anti-Catholicism, and it was believed by some that Catholicism was irreconcilable with American citizenship. They pointed to the fact that the Vatican had issued encyclicals against freedom of speech, the press, and religion, and that the Pope had proclaimed against the separation of church and state. They claimed that true Catholics subject to papal decree were not free, but were in fact under the control of a foreign power. The Knights of Columbus are also a fraternal organization, again, some say a secret society, that was originated by an Irish Catholic priest, Father Michael J. McGivney, in 1881 in New Haven, Connecticut. It was founded as a temperance society that also embraced the goal of providing insurance for widows and orphans. At the time, American insurance societies required secrecy from their members, so the organization devised secret rituals and rites that blended Catholic symbolism with American patriotism and named itself in honor of Christopher Columbus. The Knights of Columbus were in the forefront of those Catholics referred to as Americanists, who proclaimed that in their view there was no conflict between Catholic faith and American freedom. The organization flourished, and by the early 20th century there were more than 300,000 members. During the election year of 1912, there was a resurgence of anti-Catholicism in America, and much of it was directed at the Knights of Columbus. It was claimed by some, and believed by many Freemasons, that the Knights of Columbus was a sham organization whose real goal was to undermine American institutions and that they were secretly acting on the orders of the Pope. Such was the political and religious climate of the America in which Napoleon Hill was raised. Resuming Napoleon Hill's original text and his story about his encounter with a young man wearing the Knights of Columbus pin. All the remainder of that day, I kept thinking of the incident because it bothered me. I had always taken considerable pride in the thought that I was tolerant with everyone, but here was a spontaneous outburst of intolerance that proved there was something in my subconscious mind that was creating narrow-mindedness. This discovery so shocked me that I began a systematic process of self-analysis through which I searched into the very depths of my soul for the cause of my rudeness. I asked myself over and over again why I had so abruptly released that young man's hand and turned away from him when I knew nothing about him. Of course, the answer always led me back to that Knights of Columbus pin he wore, but that was not a real answer, and therefore it did not satisfy me. Then I began to do some research work in the field of religion. I began to study both Catholicism and Protestantism, until I had traced both back to their beginnings, a process that I must confess brought me more understanding of the problems of life than I had gathered from all other sources. For one thing, it disclosed the fact that Catholicism and Protestantism differ more in form than they do in effect, that both are founded on exactly the same cause, which is Christianity. But this was by no means all, nor was it the most important of my discoveries, for my research led, of necessity, in many directions and forced me into the field of biology, where I learned much that I needed to know about life in general and the human being in particular. My research also led to the study of Darwin's hypothesis of evolution, as outlined in his The Origin of Species, and this, in turn, led to a much wider analysis of the subject of psychology than any I had previously made. As I reached out for knowledge, my mind began to unfold and broaden with such alarming rapidity that I practically found it necessary to wipe the slate of what I believed to be my previously gathered knowledge and to unlearn much that I had previously believed to be truth. Comprehend the meaning of what I have just said. Imagine yourself suddenly discovering that most of your philosophy of life had been built of bias and prejudice, making it necessary for you to acknowledge that, far from being a finished scholar, you were barely qualified to become an intelligent student. That was exactly the position in which I found myself, with respect to many of what I believed to be sound fundamentals of life. But of all the discoveries to which this research led, none was more important than that of the relative importance of physical and social heredity. For it was through this discovery that I came to understand the cause for my action when I turned away from a man I did not know. It was this discovery that disclosed to me how and where I acquired my views of religion, of politics, of economics, and of many other equally important subjects. I both regret and rejoice to say that I found most of my views on these subjects without support by even a reasonable hypothesis, much less sound facts or reason. I then recalled a conversation between the late Senator Robert L. Taylor and myself, in which we were discussing the subject of politics. It was a friendly discussion, as we were of the same political faith, but the senator had asked me a question for which I never forgave him until I began this research. "I see that you are a very staunch Democrat," he said, "and I wonder if you know why you are." I thought of the question for a few seconds, then blurted out this reply. "I am a Democrat because my father was one, of course." With a broad grin on his face, the senator then nailed me with this response. "Just as I thought. Now, wouldn't you be in a bad fix if your father had been a horse thief?" It was many years later, after I began the research work I mentioned, that I understood the real meaning of Senator Taylor's response. Too often, we hold opinions that are based on no sounder a foundation than it being what someone else believes. To better illustrate the far-reaching effects of one of the important principles uncovered by the incident to which I have referred, and that you may learn how and where you acquired your philosophy of life in general, that you may trace your prejudices and your biases to their original source, and that you may discover, as I discovered, how largely you are the result of the training you received before you reached the age of 15 years. I will now quote from a plan that I submitted to Mr. Edward Bok's committee, the American Peace Award for the Abolition of War. This plan covers not only the most important of the principles, but it also shows how the principle of organized effort may be applied to one of the most important of the world's problems. At the same time, it gives you a more comprehensive idea of how to apply this principle in the attainment of your definite chief aim. How to Abolish War. The background. There are two important factors that constitute the chief controlling forces of civilization. One is physical heredity, and the other is social heredity. The size and form of the body, the texture of the skin, the color of the eyes, and the functioning power of the vital organs are all the result of physical heredity. They are static and fixed and cannot be changed, for they are the result of a million years of evolution. But by far, the most important part of what we are is the result of social heredity, which is affected through our environment and early training. Our conception of religion, politics, economics, philosophy, and other subjects of a similar nature, including war, is entirely the result of those dominating forces of our environment and training. The Catholic is a Catholic because of their early training, and the Protestant is a Protestant for the same reason. But this is hardly stating the truth with sufficient emphasis, for it might be properly said that the Catholic is a Catholic and the Protestant is a Protestant because they cannot help it. With few exceptions, the religion of the adult is the result of their religious training during the years between 4 and 14, when their religion was forced on them by their parents or those who had control of their schooling. A prominent clergyman indicated how well he understood the principle of social heredity when he said, "Give me the control of a child until he is 12 years old, and you can teach it any religion you may please after that time, for I will have planted my own religion so deeply in its mind that no power on earth could undo my work." The outstanding and most prominent of man's beliefs are those that were forced upon him or that he absorbed of his own volition under highly emotionalized conditions when his mind was receptive. Under such conditions, the evangelist can plant the idea of religion more deeply and permanently during an hour's revival service than he could through years of training under ordinary conditions when the mind was not in an emotionalized state. The people of the United States have immortalized Washington and Lincoln because they were the leaders of the nation during times when the minds of the people were highly emotionalized, as the result of calamities that shook the very foundation of our country and vitally affected the interests of all the people. Through the principle of social heredity, operating through the schools as in the teaching of American history and through other forms of impressive teaching, the immortality of Washington and Lincoln is planted in the minds of the young and in that way kept alive. The three great organized forces through which social heredity operates are the schools, the churches, and the press. Any ideal that has the active cooperation of these three forces may, during the brief period of one generation, be forced upon the minds of the young so effectively that they cannot resist it. From the editors. The Great War that had just ended 10 years previously had a profound effect on Napoleon Hill. At the time, many people, Hill included, felt that after such widespread devastation, the world had finally realized the futility of war. It was with that spirit of idealism that Hill included in this lesson an extensive dissertation in which he proposed a plan that he believed would ensure world peace. In retrospect, it is apparent that Hill was too idealistic and naive in his worldview. Events were already underway that within a dozen years would find the world torn apart by a Second World War. As it appeared in the original edition, Hill's peace plan made numerous references to people and events whose relevance has long since faded into history and would mean little to the modern listener. The edited version that follows presents the basic principles behind Hill's vision which pertain directly to the subject of this lesson. However, the editors would like to point out that, although Napoleon Hill was overly optimistic about the world's desire for peace, he was not unaware that the key to his solution was actually a double-edged sword. As you listen to his observations about Germany, Japan, and Russia, Hill is once again proved prescient. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. In 1914, the world awoke one morning to find itself aflame with warfare on a scale previously unheard of, and the outstanding feature of importance of that worldwide calamity was the highly organized German armies. For more than 3 years, these armies gained ground so rapidly that world domination by Germany seemed certain. The German military machine operated with efficiency such as had never before been demonstrated in warfare. With Kultur, spelled K-U-L-T-U-R, as her avowed ideal, Germany swept the opposing armies before her as though they were leaderless, despite the fact that the Allied forces outnumbered her own on every front. The capacity for sacrifice in the German soldiers in support of Kultur was the outstanding surprise of the war, and that capacity was largely the result of the work of two men. Through the German educational system, which they controlled, the psychology that carried the world into war in 1914 was created in the definite form of Kultur. These men were Adalbert Falk, Prussian Minister of Education until 1879, and the German Emperor William II. Editor's comment. Kultur, as it is spelled and used here by Napoleon Hill, was in common usage at the time to refer to those characteristics that distinguished the German nation in the late 19th and early 20th century. Those characteristics were a sense of national pride and a belief in Germany's natural superiority over other nations and peoples. a policy of militant expansionism, a highly systemized social order, and the belief in the subordination of the individual to the good of the state. Back to the original text. The agency through which these men produced this result was social heredity, the imposing of an ideal on the minds of the young under highly emotionalized conditions. The teachers and professors were forced to implant the national ideal of Kultur in the minds of the young of Germany, beginning first in the elementary schools and extending on up through the high schools and universities. And out of this teaching, in a single generation, grew a capacity for sacrifice of the individual for the interest of the nation that surprised the modern world. As author Benjamin Kidd so well stated it, the aim of the state of Germany was to orientate public opinion through the heads of both its spiritual and temporal departments, through the bureaucracy, through the officers of the army, through the state direction of the press, and, last of all, through the state direction of the entire trade and industry of the nation, so as to bring the idealism of the whole people to a conception of, and to a support of, the national policy of modern Germany. Germany controlled the press, the clergy, and the schools. Therefore, is it any wonder that she grew an army of soldiers during one generation that represented to a man her ideal of Kultur? Is it any wonder that the German soldiers faced certain death with fearless impunity when one stops to consider that they had been taught from early childhood that this sacrifice was a rare privilege? Turn now from this brief description of the modus operandi through which Germany prepared her people for war to Japan. No Western nation, with the exception of Germany, has so clearly manifested its understanding of the far-reaching influence of social heredity as has Japan. Within a single generation, Japan has advanced to the ranks of nations that are the recognized powers of the civilized world. Study Japan, and you will find that she forces upon the minds of her young, through exactly the same agencies employed by Germany, the ideal of subordination of individual rights for the sake of accumulation of power by the nation. In all of her controversies with China, competent observers have seen that behind the apparent causes of the controversies was Japan's stealthy attempt to control the minds of the young by controlling the schools. If Japan could control the minds of the young of China, she could dominate that gigantic nation within one generation. To study the effect of social heredity as it is being used for the development of a national ideal by still another nation, observe what has been going on in Russia since the ascendancy to power of the Soviet government, which is now patterning the minds of the young to conform with a national ideal. That ideal, when fully developed during the maturity of the present generation, will represent exactly what the Soviet government wishes it to represent. Of all the flood of propaganda concerning the Soviet government of Russia that has been poured into this country through the tens of thousands of columns of newspaper space devoted to it since the close of the war, the following brief dispatch is by far the most significant. The headline reads, Russ Reds Order Books. Contracts being let in Germany for 20 million volumes. Educational propaganda is aimed chiefly at children. By George Witz. Special cable to the Chicago Daily News Foreign Service, Berlin, Germany, November 9, 1920. Contracts for printing 20 million books in the Russian language, chiefly for children, are being placed in Germany on behalf of the Soviet government by Gershebin, a well-known Petrograd publisher and a friend of Maxim Gorky. Far from being shocked by this significant press dispatch, the majority of the newspapers of America did not publish it, and those that did give it space placed it in an obscure part of the paper, in small type. Its real significance will become more apparent some 20-odd years from now, when the Soviet government of Russia will have grown an army of soldiers who will support, to the man, whatever national ideal the Soviet government sets up. Editor's comment. At the time, the Russian Revolution of 1917, in which the Tsarist monarchy was overthrown, was still much in the news. The future implications of such a massive communist regime were not yet clear, but obviously Hill was concerned by the potential. As the world was to learn over the next 70 years, some of Hill's worst fears were realized. Back to Hill's original text. The possibility of war exists as stern reality today solely because the principle of social heredity has not only been used as a sanctioning force in support of war, but it has actually been used as a chief agency through which the minds of men have been deliberately prepared for war. For evidence with which to support this statement, examine any national or world history and observe how tactfully and effectively war has been glorified and so described that it not only did not shock the mind of the student, but it actually established a plausible justification of war.